From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Well, U.S. companies say they're protecting human rights in China, but in point of fact, the sad reality is that on a daily basis, they are systematically violating the most fundamental rights of the people in China.
Made in China, as Congress is poised to vote on China's trade status, a look at the role of U.S. companies in denying human and worker rights there. Also, days of rage as Israeli troops withdraw from South Lebanon, violence escalates throughout the West Bank. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It's coming down. South Carolina's governor today plans to sign a bill removing the Confederate flag from the State House dome. Before the signing, Jim Hodges will give a rare live televised speech. His spokesperson says the governor will talk about where the state goes from here. Lawmakers last week approved removing the controversial flag from the State House dome, something flag critics have long been demanding. But the controversy is not over. The bill also calls for flying a similar flag at the Confederate Soldier Monument on the State House grounds. Flag opponents say it'll still be too visible. The NAACP is vowing to continue its boycott of South Carolina until the flag no longer flies on State House grounds. Retired General Colin Powell is facing a protest today by striking members of the Screen Actors Guild. The union is angry over a non-union public service announcement he's making for the youth advocacy group he heads. The group is America's Promise, the Alliance for Youth. Filming on the spot began Sunday outside Baltimore, and Powell is scheduled to film his segment today. A spokesperson for the group says the shoot won't be canceled. The union plans to set up pickets. The clash is a painful one for SAG. The union has sponsored programs for America's Promise and has arranged classroom visits by actors in the past. The spot is to be unveiled next month at the National Community Service Conference in Orlando, Florida. Last night, U.S. and British warplanes bombed civil and service installations in southern Iraq, injuring an Iraqi civilian. They also bombed in the north. And this comes as the United States should dismember Iraq, splitting it into several different states, says an advisor to Republican presidential candidate George W. Bush. Robert Zolik, an undersecretary of state under Bush's father, made the controversial suggestion at a Washington think tank last week. His comments suggest Bush might be a far more aggressive president than Bill Clinton, and they also amount to criticism of his father, George Bush. Zolik said, at some point we know that Saddam will move first, and that at that point, as opposed to letting him get an additional step, I think for one step forward, he has to get two steps back. Zolik went on to say that means that we essentially undermine his position within his own country, also with the Russians, the French, and others, and that means slowly taking away pieces of his territory. We have started that in the north. I believe we could do that in the south. Again, that quote from Robert Zolik, an undersecretary of state under George W. Bush's father, President George Bush. Federal regulators say it's time for new laws to protect consumer privacy online. In a report to Congress, the Federal Trade Commission concludes that companies aren't safeguarding personal information collected on their websites. The commission recommends legislation that would require commercial websites to tell consumers what information is collected and how it'll be used. It also says consumers should have the option to choose whether information can be shared with third parties at all. The agency also wants consumers to be able to review any information collected about them. Industry groups say privacy regulation would hinder the ability of the internet to respond quickly to new consumer demands. A handful of House members will decide whether the U.S. grants permanent normal trade relations with China. The bill could come up for a vote as early as tomorrow, and both supporters and opponents say it will be very close. We'll have more on that in just a minute. Just before being diagnosed with prostate cancer, New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani had proposed eliminating a cancer screening program for the uninsured. It was part of the budget he submitted. The program, which costs $750,000, screens for prostate, breast, and ovarian cancers. It also includes outreach and education programs. This news from Kansas City, Missouri. Police across the country sidestep state laws to ensure that millions of dollars seized in drug raids and traffic stops remain in police hands. This according to the Kansas City Star. In a year-long investigation, the Star examined more than two dozen states to determine how law enforcement officers handle forfeited drug money and property. The newspaper found that in each state examined, police use federal law enforcement to circumvent their own state laws and keep most of the money for themselves. The Star reported in the first of a two-part series Sunday that police retain most of the money by calling a federal agency during a drug seizure instead of going to state court. An agency such as the Drug Enforcement Administration accepts the seizure, making it a federal case. The DEA keeps a cut of the money and returns the rest to the police. As a result, state courts are bypassed. Consequently, millions of dollars that lawmakers have designated for education, drug treatment programs, and other purposes instead stay with police. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Congress is scheduled to vote tomorrow on whether to grant permanent normal trading relations to China. President Clinton has called the pact essential on moral, economic, and national security grounds. Proponents and opponents alike agreed that neither side had secured the 218 House votes needed to pass or kill the measure, one of the most bitterly debated issues of Clinton's presidency. Thus, they continue to woo the few dozen undecided members whose yeas or nays will determine the outcome in tomorrow's scheduled roll call. In a speech this week, President Clinton gave special emphasis to the issue of human rights in China, saying human rights situation there will improve if the nation's forced to abide by international laws and customs governing trade. In past years, Congress has conducted an annual debate and vote on whether to continue normal trade relations with China. Clinton, most GOP leaders, and major business groups want to make those normal trade relations permanent. We're joined right now by Charlie Kernaghan. He is director of the National Labor Committee, which is based in New York, and he's author of a new report called Made in China, The Role of U.S. Companies in Denying Human and Worker Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
So, what did you find?
Well, you know, we've been hearing all along that the companies, North American companies in China, by their mere physical presence and the example they set, they would improve conditions for human rights and worker rights and women's rights, pay fair wages, democratic freedoms. Well, in point of fact, we found out the reality is quite different from the rhetoric. So, for example, with Walmart, which has several thousand factories hidden across China, the largest importer of goods made in China, we found a factory called Qinxi, where 1,000 workers were being held under conditions of indentured servitude. They were working from 7 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night, 7 days a week, 30 days a month, with one Sunday off, for an average wage of 3 cents an hour. However, 46% of the workers in one of the surveys we did earned nothing at all, and in fact owed money back to the company. You see, because most of the workers in China are migrant workers. So they were housed 16 people to a tiny, miserable dorm room, housed in army metal bunk beds, two and three levels high, and fed two dismal meals a day, and for that they were charged an exorbitant amount of money. So they actually owed money back to the company after working for 2 or 3 months. And when the workers tried to protest these enormously abusive conditions, 800 workers were fired in December of 1999, making Kathy Lee pocketbooks for Walmart, the largest retailer in the world. So these are the conditions, the true conditions. In fact, most of the workers in China, in these factories, producing for export to the United States, like in Nike's. Nike has 50 contractors in China, makes 40% of its sneakers worldwide in China. Well, I saw a want ad in front of one factory that made Nike caps, and it said, females only, 17 to 21, single certificate necessary. So all across China in these factories, what you see are very young women, 16 to 25 years of age. They have to be single to get a job. There's an unwritten law in these factories that if you become pregnant, you're immediately fired. You're brought into these factories and you're working 14, 15, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week during the busy season, for maybe an average wage of about 20 cents an hour, which is a starvation wage. And when the women reach 25 years of age, they're kicked out of the factories because they're used up, exhausted, worn out, broken from working these long hours 7 days a week and living under these miserable dorm conditions. If a woman in China raises a grievance, they're immediately fired. If they try to organize an independent union, as everybody knows, of course they go to prison. They're arrested, probably beaten, and they'll be in prison for 5 to 8 years under administrative detention without a trial and put into a hard labor camp for re-education. So the reality is so different from the rhetoric coming out of the business roundtable in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and out of the Clinton administration. There are no worker rights in China, and the U.S. companies do nothing to promote women's rights or worker rights.
Charles Kernighan, how did you gather this information?
Well, you know, it's impossible to research in China. The government of China has made it illegal for foreign organizations to conduct social research in China. That's how paranoid they are. In China, if a worker is seen discussing factory conditions, they can be fired. I've never seen anything like it. We did research in Haiti during the coup in El Salvador when the death squads are running wild. There was always a place you could meet. In Haiti, for example, you could meet in a church and kids would surround it. And if anything suspicious happened, people would whistle and we could all disperse. In China, there are no independent women's groups or human rights groups or labor unions, so there's no place to meet. And of course, as a North American, you stand out rather like a sore thumb. And the security people keep a lookout on the factories. So basically, we made 2 trips to China. And, you know, you pose as academics, you do different things. So we had a chance to tour some of the factories. But the real bulk of the research is being done by very courageous human rights organizations and human rights advocates inside China. We're setting up an underground, undercover research solidarity organization inside China. Now, if any of those people happen to be discovered, it's 10 years in prison for them at a minimum. So it's very risky stuff, but it's the people are brave enough, they want to go forward, and the abuses are great enough.
Well, for years, U.S. companies have claimed that their mere presence in China would help open the country to so-called American values, that we're told that U.S. companies operating in China will also be on the front lines, acting as mini universities of a sort, spreading respect for human, women's, worker rights.
Yeah, it's like Nike. You know, if you listen to them, you'd think they were a religious organization, traveling around the world to help develop poor countries. I mean, so they talk one way. But in fact, I went past a Nike factory in northern China called Sichuan, and I was shocked. And of course, these are all contractors' plants. And Nike had the swoosh painted on the outside wall of the factory and the slogan, "Just Do It." That was right behind the iron bars on the windows, right behind the locked metal gate, right behind the spiked metal fence surrounding the factory, which looked like an army barracks. We talked to people in the community, and they said, oh, yeah, in that factory, they're working like 11 to 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, for about 20 cents an hour, and they never hire anyone over 25 years of age. So the reality, again, is very different from the rhetoric. You know, there's one good example. There was a Huffy, you know, Huffy Bikes, they're a big producer in the United States. They were producing bikes in Ohio. And in July of 1998, they shut the factory down, threw 950 workers out of their jobs. They made these Huffy bikes. The company had been profitable for 9 quarters leading up to this plant closing. Huffy took the bike production to China. In the United States, the workers were paid $17 an hour. They were members of the United Steelworkers of America. Huffy shut down a profitable factory, took the work to China, to a factory called Boan. And here's the conditions in China, in this factory. 7 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night again, 7 days a week. 30 days a month with 1 day off. Workers were paid 25 cents an hour, less than 2% of wages in the United States. And when the workers tried to protest these harsh conditions, lifting these heavy bikes, they weigh 40 pounds apiece, working under these extreme temperatures, and they say in the paint and spray department the chemical odor was like unbearable, and in the welding department the heat was unbearable. Working under these conditions, they went on strike in December of 1999 in the delivery department of the factory, and every single worker was fired. So, you know, if they don't work overtime, they're fined 2 days' pay. They work overtime, there's no overtime premium. They're not allowed to talk in the factory. So, again, the rhetoric from the companies couldn't be more different from the sad reality on the ground.
We're talking to Charles Kernighan. He is head of the National Labor Committee. It's based in New York. He has been investigating companies and their contractors around the world, from El Salvador to Honduras, Nicaragua, Haiti, now in China. Let's talk for a minute about what's going to happen in Washington, D.C., and talk about your views on that.
Well, you know, there seems to have been quite a media blackout on any information critical of human rights and labor rights conditions in China, or women's rights conditions in China. It's pretty extreme, the most I've ever seen. But I think the vote will be very, very close. And what's so important about this, you know, China is the world's seventh largest economy. In 25 years, it may be the world's largest economy. When China comes into the World Trade Organization, if there's not this annual review process, if there's not this pressure on the human rights conditions in China, what you're going to have is China will unleash this race to the bottom like we've never seen it before, where trade will not be linked to respect for human rights or women's rights or worker rights or to fair wages or environmental rights. This will be a global economy with no fundamental rights, no human rights or worker rights. So it's enormously important. And for the American people, you know, we take in from China 36% to 40% of all of China's exports worldwide. 1.2 billion garments a year are imported to the United States from China. And under the WTO, that's going to go up 300%. So last year, we imported $9.2 billion worth of garments. By 2006, we will import $27.5 billion of garments, a 300% increase. And you know what the U.S. government says? It says that increase in that surge of imports from China, it's going to put pressure on employment in China, and it's going to raise wages. You know what their estimate is? By 2006, the workers in China's, their wages will go up 0.25% an hour. So, for example, if you earn $10 a week in 2006, you're going to earn $10.10 an hour. So that's the great benefit that the workers in China will receive. We take in 60% of all the shoes we purchase in the United States and sneakers come from China. 60% of all the toys and sporting goods we purchase come from China. Put those two things together, you're talking $39 billion in retail value, or more than that. China is the second largest exporter of steel to the United States and iron. 60% increase a year in auto parts imports. On and on, telecommunications up 72% over the last 4 years. So it's not just sneakers and apparel. In fact, we went into high-tech factories making Alpine car stereos, top of the line, $1,300 in the United States. And what we found were young women hunched over microscopes, staring into the microscopes, soldering the fine pieces of the stereo for 9.5 hours a day, 6 days a week for 27 cents an hour. And above them was an electronic scoreboard telling them what their production quota was for the day, which was 720 stereos, and then it monitored their progress throughout the day, how many stereos they had made in comparison to how many they should have made in order to make that, in order to make their quota. RCA televisions, you know, $299 sets, these little mini screens that come with a boombox and a CD player, you know, quite fancy. Workers in China, 20-year-old women making these RCA stereos, some girls as young as 14 years old, working from 7:30 in the morning until 9:30 at night, or 10:30 or 11 or 12. And in fact, they even had a special overtime rate of 36 cents an hour when you work past midnight. No rights whatsoever. House 12 to a room in these miserable dorm rooms. And I mean, people would have to have an image of these things where they take army bunk beds and stuff them into a room and line every inch of space with double and triple level army metal bunk beds. And the work, they leave a thin corridor down the center of the room. And the workers spend their lives when they're at the factory in these little cubicles. So your space when you're at these factories would be a 2.5 foot by 2.5 foot by 6 foot space. And the workers put little a nail in the wall, for example, hang up their few possessions, maybe two shirts, and tear a magazine picture out and tape it up to the wall. And then they drew plastic over the outside of the bunk bed. So this is the reality.
If people want to get a hold of your report, where can they call?
Well, they could get a hold of us in New York at our office at 212-242-3002, or they could go to the website. It's on the website of www.nlcnet.org.
Charlie Kernaghan, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Charlie Kernaghan is the head of the National Labor Committee, which is based in New York City. Again, the vote on the China bill is expected tomorrow. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Thank you. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Newswires are reporting today that Israel may quit South Lebanon within days, ending a 22-year occupation weeks ahead of a deadline. At a two-and-a-half-hour emergency meeting late last night, the Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, was empowered by Israel's security cabinet to speed up the withdrawal. Barak called the late-night emergency meeting as the Lebanon occupation crumbled under the advance of Hezbollah guerrillas on outposts abandoned by Israel's South Lebanon Army militia allies. As ministers plotted strategy, Israeli army reinforcements assembled at Israel's northern border and a convoy of tanks headed into South Lebanon. The security cabinet also authorized Barak, who serves as defense minister, to order troops to open fire without consulting ministers. As security sources said, the number of Lebanese killed by Israeli forces had risen to six. The Israeli army ordered residents of northern Israel into bomb shelters for fear Hezbollah would retaliate. We go now to Beirut, Lebanon, to longtime Mideast correspondent Robert Fisk, who works for the Independent of London. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you describe the situation in the south of Lebanon and the border with Israel?
Well, approximately one-third of Israel's occupation zone has now been, as they say in Lebanon, liberated. In other words, Israel's proxy militia, the South Lebanon Army, so-called, has effectively disintegrated. And has, in many cases, 375 men in total over 4 days defected to the Lebanese state, the Lebanese army, or the Hezbollah. And approximately one-third of the occupation zone is now in the hands, if that's the right word, of the Lebanese. That doesn't mean that the Hezbollah have poured into the villages. It doesn't mean that the Lebanese army has moved into them. Indeed, they have not done so. But what it does mean is that one-third of Israel's occupation zone is now no longer under Israel's control. The areas which have been evacuated by both Israel and its proxy militias are effectively Muslim areas, not Christian areas. So that doesn't mean that the war is over. It doesn't mean that the occupation zone has ended. It does mean that in the majority, the Muslim areas have been left by Israel and its allies, and they are now in the hands of the villagers, the mukhtars, the village leaders, and to some extent of the Hezbollah, in the sense that many of the Hezbollah people actually come from these villages. They left these villages as children, as babies, and have gone back with their weapons, but not as an army. There have been no revenge killings. There has been no attack on Israel. There's not been a single Katyusha across the border. But Israel, of course, is concerned that there will be, that this means that their enemies are very close to their frontier.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a Reuters piece by Miral Fahmy from Marjayoun, Lebanon. And it says, Israel's hopes of an orderly withdrawal from Lebanon appeared to be disintegrating Monday as its South Lebanon Army militia fled in the face of advancing Hezbollah guerrillas. The Israeli army said Prime Minister Ehud Barak had ordered it to be ready to end the 22-year-old occupation as early as June 1st, 5 weeks ahead of his promised deadline. And that witnesses said SLA militiamen fled to seek asylum in Israel. Can you give us the context of what is taking place here?
Well, the context is this. In 1983, when the Israelis withdrew from the northern part of their occupation zone in the Shuf Mountains, they left behind them two militias, the Falangists, who were working for them, and the Druze. And they fought it out to the death, and there was anarchy and chaos and massacres that followed their withdrawal. In 1985, they withdrew from the Lebanese city of Sidon and left behind them anarchy and chaos and fighting between Christians and Muslims. Now they are leaving again, and instead of fighting between Christians and Muslims, there is not anarchy. Hezbollah guerrillas have moved into villages which are Shia Muslim and which they originally came from. You have to remember that many of the Hezbollah members actually came from villages in the south which have been liberated. But Christian villages are still in the hands of the Israelis and of their militia allies, and they have not been handed over. So what we've had is, in effect, an Israeli withdrawal from areas which the Hezbollah are familiar with and which are sympathetic to Muslim aspirations for the liberation of Lebanon. We do not have an Israeli withdrawal from areas where Christians who have been loyal to them all along are living. So while in many ways this has been an extraordinary day in Lebanese history in the sense that nobody has been killed in revenge, it doesn't mean that no one will be, but no one has been, the real test, which is when the Israelis withdraw from Christian villages, has yet to come.
Robert Fisk, you wrote a piece several weeks ago in The Independent, which was headlined, Hezbollahville is scenting victory, but not peace. Can you tell us about the story of this one place that you visited?
Yeah, I didn't read it. Didn't write it several weeks ago. I wrote it 5 days ago. This is a village, Jibshit, which is central to the Hezbollah because it has always been not the headquarters, but the inspirational center of the Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. This is a village that was left by the Israelis in 1985, which has the largest number of fighters who have died in conflict with Israelis. There are 73 corpses in the so-called Martyr Cemetery at Jibshit. The Hezbollah leadership in the village told me quite specifically that there would be a fighting retreat of the Israelis to the border. They would fight them all the way back to the frontier of southern Lebanon, but they insisted that they would not go in to Christian villages, they would not seek revenge, that they would allow the Lebanese army or the United Nations to take over those areas which they had liberated. This is their words, not mine. That there would not be, in their words, any kind of massacre that followed. So far, they have kept their word. But I repeat that only the villages which are Shiite Muslim have been evacuated so far, not Christian villages. And as we know, the leadership of the SLA, the South Lebanon Army, the proxy militia of the Israelis, have said that they would, if necessary, fight for their villages. So I don't think, unfortunately, that today's events mean that there will, even though there were three deaths killed by three innocent civilians killed by Israeli helicopter gunships, I don't think that this means that there is therefore an automatically peaceful retreat for the Israelis. There are many stories at the moment that very few Israelis are actually left in southern Lebanon. One report that has reached me is that only 140 Israeli soldiers are left in southern Lebanon. Even their the forward position at Beaufort Castle, which is a great crusader castle over the Litani River, there's a rumor that it has been abandoned and it is now empty, though no one is rash enough to walk into it. The fact of the matter is that the Christian heartland of southern Lebanon remains in Israeli hands, as does the Hiyam prison, in which there are 160 Hezbollah guerrillas imprisoned. This has not been liberated, this has not been freed, and we don't yet know whether the Israelis will take the prisoners into Israel itself against international law, or whether the Israelis are prepared to just give them up. In 1983, I watched the Israelis leave the Shuf Mountains and allow their Druze and Christian allies to fight it out. In 1985, I watched them leave Sidon and allow their Muslim and Christian allies to fight it out. It may be that the Israelis wish the Christian and Muslim people of southern Lebanon fight it out, but so far this has not happened. It has been an unrewarded war in the sense that there has not been so far a single episode of revenge killings. However, I should add that in Hiyam prison there have been the most terrible tortures carried out with electricity, whippings and beatings. And it does not mean that there will not be individual acts of revenge against Christians or Muslims who have carried out these terrible deeds. Up to now, however, the area of Hiyam prison remains in Israeli hands, and the Hezbollah have not fired a single Katyusha across the border into Israel. That doesn't mean that the Hezbollah are the good guys in any sense of the word. Anyone who thinks that they are is demented. It does mean that the worst fears of those who wish for peace in southern Lebanon have not been fulfilled.
We're talking to Robert Fisk. He's in Beirut right now.
in Lebanon, writes for The Independent for the last, well, more than 20 years. But I was wondering if you could comment, Robert, on what's happening right now in the West Bank and Gaza, and will it have any effect on Lebanon, but also just in itself, the worst violence in 2 years with thousands of people protesting. It looks like at this point at least 5 Palestinians dead, more than 100 shot by Israeli soldiers as the Palestinians were calling for more than 1,500 Palestinian prisoners to be freed.
Well, a number of Israeli academics have said for some months that there was an explosion about to happen inside the occupied West Bank because they feel, and I agree with them, that the so-called peace process, which is, in my view, an American-Israeli peace process, is not going to give justice to the Israelis. You have to go back to Oslo, 1993, and remember that the Palestinians believed that by signing an agreement with the Israelis, they would have a Palestinian state with a capital in Jerusalem. Not all of Jerusalem. By no means the whole of Jerusalem, but at least that part which was traditionally Muslim, which was Palestinian, which was Arab. And they have not been given this. And one of the greatest, indeed the only great problem now in the West Bank, inside Palestine, Israel, whatever we wish to call it, is that Palestinians are being faced with a peace process which will not give them, in their eyes, a just peace. They will not have the return of refugees. They will not have the end of settlements on occupied Arab territory. And they will not have a capital in Jerusalem. And as long as this is the case, Mr. Arafat, who is, of course, the leader of the Palestinian Authority and the chairman of the PLO, he can sign as many pieces of paper as he likes. But if people don't think it is a just peace as opposed to a peace, then there will not be a real peace between the Arabs and the Israelis. The problem is, of course, for the Arabs, that if they then say this doesn't work, the Arabs will be blamed. They will be told, you don't want peace, and the Israelis do. But at the end of the day, if they don't get a serious adjudication on the return of refugees, on the fact that they want at least a part of Jerusalem, the Arab part, as their capital, shared with the Israelis, shared with Jewish Israelis, if they do not get some kind, even if only symbolic, understanding of the return of refugees from 1948, there won't be a real peace. And that is the key now. The Americans and the Israelis, and indeed those Palestinians who go along with this idea, are saying anyone who opposes the peace process, the fact that we're using this phrase, peace process, which is a State Department language, you know, we didn't invent this phrase, peace process, they did. The idea that as long as the peace process is not fulfilled, therefore the Arabs are to blame, is one of the key motivating, energizing, explosive factors in the future. There is not going to be a Palestinian state without settlements. There is not going to be, it appears, a Palestinian state with a capital in Jerusalem. There is not going to be a return of refugees in any form to Israel or to that part of Palestine that became Israel in 1948. And what has happened, in effect, is that the Palestinian Arabs are being presented with a peace process, or a peace, I'm using the same words as you now, are being presented with a peace which is not going to fulfill their desires. And however many people, as I say, sign the pieces of paper saying there is peace and it's okay, unless there is a just peace, there will not be an end to war.
The latest news you must have heard is Ehud Barak, the Israeli prime minister, faced with this upsurge of Hezbollah attacks, says the Financial Times. Unrest among Palestinians and instability in his coalition postponed a visit to the U.S. He was supposed to come here on Monday.
Yes, well, it's the same answer, I'm afraid. The Hezbollah are continuing to attack Israeli occupation forces in southern Lebanon, which they are internationally entitled to do. We may not wish them to. We may wish they would allow the Israelis to go quietly back to the border. But under UN Security Council Resolution 425, the Israelis have had 22 years to go back to their border, and under the resolution they must do so immediately and unconditionally. They cannot expect internationally and under international law to do so in peace. Again, I repeat, they will win the propaganda war by saying they are obeying UN Security Council resolution 425. The fact of the matter is that they've had 22 years to do it and haven't done so, and now under constant attack by the Lebanese resistance or the Hezbollah, they are getting out. Why are they getting out of southern Lebanon now and not, for example, out of the Syrian Golan Heights, which they also occupy? And the answer is very simply, they're not being attacked on the Golan Heights. And this raises the issue of Syria, which is probably your next question.
Yes, go right ahead.
Well, yes, I will. The Syrian regime of President Hafez al-Assad wants the Israelis to withdraw from the Golan Heights. The Israelis, if they are prepared to do so, have had numerous opportunities in peace negotiations with the Syrians to say that they will. Under UN Security Council Resolution 242, here we have another resolution, this time from 1967, the Israelis are obliged to pull out of all of the Golan Heights back to the international frontier. They have not done so, and it's still under negotiation. Now, the Lebanese realize that if they had not fought for their part of southern Lebanon, they wouldn't be getting it back. After all, why are the Israelis keen to leave the south of Lebanon but not Golan? Because they are bleeding in southern Lebanon, but they're not bleeding in Golan. For the Syrians, they've always seen the battle in southern Lebanon as a method of putting pressure on the Israelis. If the Israelis leave all of southern Lebanon untouched, there is no more pressure they can put on the Israelis to give back Golan. So the Syrians have no interest in seeing a peaceful Israeli retreat from southern Lebanon. And that is the most cynical and the most dangerous part of the present events.
Finally, Robert Fisk, back on the issue of the Palestinian really uprising, what some might be calling the Second Intifada, is the Palestinians who turned on their own security forces and the prisoners who are in jail right now. Who are these prisoners, and what is the significance of the Palestinians being attacked by Palestinian forces?
Well, there are two issues here. Under the various agreements that were made following Oslo, a large number of Palestinian prisoners were to be released. Some of these prisoners were people who were taken as hostages. Some of them were taken because they were relatives of people who were anti-Israeli. Some of them were people who had committed dreadful crimes against Israel. At the end of a war, you have to forgive your enemies. The real problem, however, is that if the Israelis wish to withdraw from the West Bank and from southern Lebanon and from Golan, these issues of history must be set aside. There are many Israelis who believe this is the case. There are many Israelis who believe that a withdrawal from the West Bank means all the West Bank, not keeping part of it for security issues or whatever you may describe them. As long as the Israelis do not do this, the large majority of the Palestinians in the West Bank will not believe that this is a just peace. They may believe it's a peace. You know, you can produce peace off a supermarket shelf with, like, 3 kilos of peace, 2 kilos of human rights or whatever. But that is the issue. And ever since Oslo, over the last 7 years, the Palestinian Authority has increased its cooperation, not just with the Israelis, but the Americans, and therefore the CIA. And this has meant, in effect, that anyone who opposes the Arab-Israeli peace, by which I suppose we mean the American-Israeli peace, is a, quote, terrorist, unquote, a word that I don't use in my reports and which my newspaper doesn't use for obvious reasons. But the real problem is that as long as there is not a just peace, as long as the Palestinians don't get what they feel they were promised, which is a state with a capital in Jerusalem and with a contiguous territory and an end to settlements and a return of refugees, however much it may be dressed up by the Americans, however much it may be agreed and signed by Yasser Arafat, it will not be a real peace. And that's why we've got the burgeoning possibility and danger and nightmare of a second intifada.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert, and good luck with your cat. That won't go on the air.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 13 years ago, Ben Linder was killed in Nicaragua. In the summer of 1983, a young American engineer and unicyclist flew to Managua, Nicaragua, as one of thousands of foreigners offering their skills and support of the Sandinista government. While waiting for an engineering job, Ben performed as a clown in the circus and in poor neighborhoods, leading children to newly opened health clinics for vaccinations. When the U.S. threatened to invade Nicaragua, he joined his neighbors in digging bomb shelters, and over the next 4 years, his life became increasingly entwined in the life of this country at war. But on April 28, 1987, he died, and Joan Krukowicz is with us to talk about that day and what Ben was doing in Nicaragua. She's written his story. It's called The Death of Ben Linder, The Story of a North American and Sandinista in Nicaragua. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Joan Krukowicz.
Thank you, Amy.
Tell us about Ben Linder, who he was, and why he died.
Ben Linder was a young unicyclist, clown, and engineer who grew up in Portland, Oregon, and he went to Nicaragua in 1983 to use his engineering skills to help the Sandinista revolution. He was there 4 years, and he was killed by the U.S.-backed Contras in an ambush in 1987. He was the first American to be killed by the Contras, and his death caused a great impact in the United States because basically our tax dollars financed his death.
Did you know him?
I met Ben Linder in 1983. I also went down to Nicaragua in 83 to become a journalist, and I was the Pacifica correspondent for 1984 and part of 1985. I ended up leaving in 1991.
Tell us how it was that Ben Linder died.
Ben Linder was killed by the U.S.-backed Contras in an ambush. He was surveying a small stream outside of the town of San Jose de Bocay, way up in the northern mountains, about 25 miles from the Contra camps. The Contras had their camps across the border in Honduras. And he was working on this stream, surveying it with a group of Nicaraguans. When the Contras ambushed him, they killed him and two Nicaraguans.
We're talking to Joan Krukowicz. She is the author of a new book called The Death of Ben Linder, The Story of a North American and Sandinista, Nicaragua. Joan, you were able to get CIA documents talking about what actually happened to Ben, the connection of the U.S. government to the Contras. Can you talk about the larger context for young people who don't even really know anything about what happened in Nicaragua? You can tell us through Ben Linder's story, the story of Nicaragua.
That's what I cover in the book. I cover the years from 1983 to 1987, and it is not only Ben's story. It's the story of 100,000 Americans who visited Nicaragua during that time. Internationalists, people went down there to pick coffee, pick cotton, who were on work brigades to build clinics, build schools, who are part of the Sister City operation, the groups that there were in the United States at that time, solidarity groups. So it is it's a story of not only Ben's story, but it's the story of Americans, and it's also the story of the war, of the Reagan administration's war against a small country. And since I was a reporter, I was able to fit a lot of the stories that I covered into the book, mixed along with Ben's story. And Ben's story is very interesting because, I mean, he was a very interesting person because he was not only an engineer, but he was a clown, which you have to admit is a very strange kind of pastime for an engineer. He liked children. He loved Nicaragua. He really tried to get involved in the culture. He lived with a Nicaraguan family. He fell in love, so there's a love story in the book, too. It's a story of war, of love, and of passion, because Ben really wanted to help the Nicaraguans. He really wanted to work out in a small village and bring electricity to a small village in the mountains. He was an engineer, and his specialty was hydroelectricity, and that's what he aimed to do, and along with a team of Nicaraguans, he was successful in doing that.
What about CIA documents?
The CIA documents I was not able to get until the mid-90s. They were gotten through the Freedom of Information Act. And through the CIA documents, I learned the identities of the 12 Contras who killed Ben. It actually had their names down in the documents. So I returned back to the Nicaragua Mountains. This was all in the 90s, long after the war was over. And I was able to track down actually one of the people who pulled the trigger and who killed Ben. Most of the people who were in that group had been killed. About 6 out of the 12 had been killed. But some settled in the very village that Ben was working in when he was killed. And actually, those Contras are the beneficiaries of the light, that the project that Ben was working on and when he was murdered by them.
So who were these killers?
Basically, the one that I spoke to was a young kid who had been with the Contras for many, many years. And he said his story was that the Contras had received information that a group of Nicaraguans, along with one foreigner, and the official story, at least in the CIA documents, is that the foreigner was a Cuban, that they were working on a dam to bring electricity to this town. And because the goal of the Contras was to kill anybody who was affiliated with the government. It didn't matter if they were physicians or if they were teachers or if they were engineers or whatever. The Contras set up an ambush early in the morning, and as soon as Ben and the group of Nicaraguans arrived, they opened up fire on them and then threw grenades into a gorge and killed Ben and two Nicaraguans. The CIA documents basically outlined how the ambush had taken place, but I did not receive any analysis of the ambush or any information about how that Contra group received the information or who they received it from. So I think there's still a lot of holes in the story, and I'm not really sure if I have all of the documents. I probably don't, and I'll probably find, 5 or 10 years down the road that some more documents will be released. When Ben was killed, a lot of people thought that he was targeted. He, Ben Linder, personally was targeted by the CIA and by the Contras. And I asked the Contra that. I said, was Ben targeted? He said no. But, I mean, do I believe him? I don't know. Did he tell the truth? I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever know.
How did the CIA come to know who all the people were who had killed Ben Linder and two other Nicaraguans?
That is a very interesting question. Obviously, there were reports from the Contras that were being kept in CIA file. From the CIA documents, I found reports on other attacks that had taken place. Like I said, the CIA file was very incomplete. And when I went and asked the Contras for documents, they said all the documents, their documents, had been destroyed. So I think that there's still a lot more CIA documents out there.
What did the CIA and the U.S. government tell Ben Linder's parents in the wake of the murder?
The CIA, the State Department, said basically that that Ben was on the wrong side and that they were sorry for his death, but they couldn't guarantee any American safety who was in a war zone. It was a very cynical letter that the parents received. When Ben was killed, his death was debated very strongly in Congress, in the United States, on talk shows, on TV, and some representatives of the Reagan administration called him a traitor, a communist. They said that he deserved what he got. And other people called him a hero, a martyr. They said he represented the best that Americans had to offer, that he believed in a cause, and that he was working to help people and not to destroy things as the Reagan administration was doing in Nicaragua.
Again, Joan Crookwood, our guest. She's author of The Death of Ben Linder, a story of North American in Sandinista Nicaragua. She was a journalist who lived in Nicaragua from 1983 to 91, covered the war between the Sandinistas and the U.S.-backed Contras for ABC Radio, as well as Pacifica Radio, Monitor Radio, Canadian Broadcasting, and other outlets. She's currently writing a book on U.S.-trained death squads in the 1980s in Honduras. 1987, was the Bolin Amendment in effect that said that the Contras could not be supported by the United States?
The Bolin Amendment had gone into effect a couple years earlier, and it basically, supposedly, theoretically, cut off all arms to and monies to the Contras. However, unbeknownst to us at that time, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North was running his secret arms supply to the Contras. And as a journalist, when I was down there, this was in the years 84, 85, it was very interesting because the Contra army was getting larger. They had better and better weapons, yet supposedly they weren't getting any kind of aid from the United States because the Bolin Amendment outlawed that. But in 1986, the Sandinista Army shot down a supply plane. It was ferrying arms to the Contras, and in that plane was three Americans. Two of them died. One of them parachuted to the ground, Eugene Hassenfuss, a former Marine from Wisconsin. And he was put on trial, and I, as a journalist, covered that trial in Managua. And Eugene Hassenfuss told everything. He told all that he knew. And basically, the information that he gave led to the discovery of the Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North's secret ferrying of arms, and to the Iran-Contra scandal,
which was
basically that Colonel Oliver North was selling arms illegally to the Iranians, taking the profits and giving that money to the Contras to buy arms, also another illegal deed.
And Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North ended up running for the Senate as a Republican candidate in Virginia and is a talk show host today. You're currently writing a book on Honduras and U.S. support of death squads there at the same time that Ben Linder was being killed in Nicaragua. What's the connection and what kind of U.S. involvement was there in Honduras?
In the early 80s, when I was a journalist, I was able to cover both Nicaragua and Honduras. Then, as the war deepened in Nicaragua, I stayed mostly in Nicaragua. But unbeknownst to a lot of people, the CIA was very involved in creating a death squad in Honduras. There's not too much written on this. There's not a lot of information, and I'm putting together the information that exists and also doing interviews. I'm also hoping that some CIA documents will come out on this subject. There's been some Freedom of Information Acts filed on the Honduran death squads, and hopefully some CIA documents will be released, but this takes years. Freedom of Information Act takes years.
What was the battalion?
The battalion was called 316. And basically, the CIA and other units of the United States selected Honduran soldiers and brought them together to a secret base for training. It's thought that the Army base was in Texas, and kept them there for about 3 months, trained them in intelligence and basically torture, and then brought them back to Honduras and let them loose. And they basically went after anybody who they considered radical, be it journalists, students, lawyers, labor leaders. And they brought these, they kidnapped these people, sort of like the dirty war in Argentina, that where 10,000 people disappeared in the 70s. But on a much smaller scale. But the Hondurans used that as their model. They kidnapped people and then tortured them and then killed them.
As we wrap up, can the Linders, Ben's parents, sue the United States government for his wrongful death, considering they clearly were very much on top of what happened, not to mention financially and militarily supporting the Contras that killed him?
The Linders do have a suit right now against the Contras. It's been in court for years and years. And it doesn't look like that there's going to be an outcome soon on this, but soon after he was killed, they did file a suit on wrongful death.
And where is it?
It's been through many revisions, and it was actually thrown out once, and then it was appealed, and now they're gathering more information on the appeal.
Joan Cruckwit. She is author of The Death of Ben Linder, The Story of a North American in Sandinista, Nicaragua. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Matthew Finch is our engineer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!